precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step one. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Jack and BJ. All right. So, I'll read the first paragraph on page XXVI. We're in the Roman numerals. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. So, step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking, just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may of course mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that its explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So, who wants to go first?
You want to go after me? Okay. Yeah. You know, when I was drinking, I thought that, well, I was in full flight from reality, and I knew it as a young teenager when I started drinking at 13. And once it changed the way I felt and did all the things that it did for me, I was in full flight from reality. Well, not at that point. I was just chasing a lot of fun at that point. But when it got really bad, as it progressed, I knew I was in full flight from reality. I couldn't stand the way I felt most of the time. And I thought I was a bad person. See, I knew I was a little crazy, but I really thought I was a bad person because it didn't never occur to me that I had a physical maladjustment as well as mentally skewed. You see, I thought I wanted the next drink. I mean, once I had the first couple and I got that sense of relief, I thought it was my own decision making that was making me want to have another one and another one and another one, and it never occurred to me that I was reacting to a physical allergy. And as things got worse, you know, I just thought I was a bad person, especially when you have people telling you all the time, well, why can't you, and haven't you, you know, and and things just get progressively worse and worse. So, you know, the idea that that it is not only a mental illness but also a physical illness was a bit of a relief to me the first time I got sober, the first time, because I had this sense of relief that I wasn't really crazy, you know, that it wasn't necessarily all my fault. And I got a little sense of, just like if someone got diagnosed with a terrible disease that they, you know, and I had that feeling like, okay, maybe I'm not all that crazy. So I got a little sense of relief from realizing that it was also a physical condition.
Thanks. My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
BJ.
My sobriety date is April 26, 2015, and this is my home group. Thanks for letting me share. yeah, that's it. No. The doctor's opinion is super important if you're new. This just explains why you can't drink like other people, and that was super helpful to me at first. When I came to AA, my sponsor had me read the doctor's opinion, and you're going to be qualifying yourself. So you're going to look to see what you relate to. And I think I can best describe this paragraph in my life with the physical craving, almost like an allergy, with a story. So one of my last drunks, it was actually the weekend before I came to AA for good. My husband and I had an engagement party to go to, and we were the first ones there. We even were there before the couple, and there was a bar set up, and the band was already playing, and I had already told myself, I'm not drinking tonight, which, by the way, I told myself pretty much the last year of my drinking every single time I drank. And we get the bars there, and I think my husband was kind of reading me, and he was like, well, let's go dance, even though it's just the two of us. That might be kind of cute, right? So we're dancing to this song, and I'm like looking over his shoulder, and the whole time all I'm seeing is that bar. I'm not even in the moment, man. All I'm thinking about is, how am I gonna get a drink? I need a drink. Like, we didn't even make it through the song, and I said to him, you know, would you like a drink? I think I'm gonna have just a couple drinks. And he's like, I mean, whatever you want to do. I think probably at this point in his mind, he's like, ah, crap. But nevertheless, went over and got whatever to drink. It really doesn't matter. And in the next 3 hours, I mean, you know, I drank. And finally, they said last call, and they started flicking the lights, and they were poised to boot us out. And so everybody starts going towards the door, and I start to panic because we have like a 45-minute drive home. I need more to drink, man. Like, I can't just stop there. I'm not done. I've only had probably like 12 to 15 drinks. You know what I mean? And I see that they've closed the bar down. So on my way out, there are all these random glasses on those tall, like, hors d'oeuvre tables with the tablecloths that random people have abandoned with, like, a half an inch or an inch of wine in them. I'm just grabbing them, drink on my way out. And I don't think this is a problem, by the way, because, you know, I'm the kind of person, I don't like wasting. I'll eat out of a trash can. I'll drink that leftover wine. I think that's an asset. I'm low maintenance. You know what I mean? Like, and this is the insanity that works in my life to tell me what I'm doing is okay. But really, deep down at my core, I need that drink. I've already started drinking, and I'm not in charge of saying when I stop. My alcoholism is, the drink is. That's what decides when I stop. That was basically how my drinking was for as long as I can remember. But it is progressive, so, you know, it wasn't always quite that twisted, but it's crazy how long we can convince ourselves that, you know, we're not different from other people. But when it comes down to it, the person that you go to dinner with and drinks half a beer, that alcohol is not doing for them what it does for you. We are bodily different from people who can drink normally and will never be able to drink safely again. And that's what I have to believe at my innermost core before I can do this. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks. All right, now we're gonna move over to page XXVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
I'm Jack. I'm an alcoholic. I forgot to tell you my sobriety date is September 11, 2009, and my home group is Living Sober on 49th Street on Thursdays. I bounced in and out of AA for 18 years after I got sober the first time. And I had 9 geographical cures in 10 years. I was like the Minute Man. I knew exactly how to load up a 15-foot Ryder truck and get all my stuff in there and go to the next job. And I would take it. And I would take it. If it was, $1,000 more a year, I was single, I'd go. Well, really what I was doing was I was running away from my alcoholism, because I kept thinking that, this time it'll be different. This will be a new city, a new place. No one's going to know me, and it's going to be different. And it never was different. It always got worse. It was only a matter of days before I found people that were like me and places to go where there was people like me. And my reality was so warped that I just thought this was the way you lived, because it's the way I lived. It never occurred, I had buddies from high school that ended up on the street. I had people that died as a result of alcohol and drugs. I had my best friend in the 80s blew his brains out at Waterside, and we were both bouncing in and out of meetings here in Ghent and around Norfolk. And there were times when we were both sober, there were times when he was sober, I was drunk, there were times it was the other way around, times we were both drunk. But I'm talking about a smart, funny, intelligent, handsome guy that, just couldn't take it anymore. Just couldn't take the suffering anymore. Couldn't stand it. And that didn't sober me up. Losing jobs never sobered me up. Losing relationships never sobered me up. The guy that was here last week really said it really well when he said, when you just can't take the misery, when the misery becomes so intolerable, that's when you'll do something. And I thought, well, that's really putting it pretty well, because that's really the reality of it, is nothing could scare me away from drinking because drinking was my solution. I couldn't stand living in reality. I always wanted to be wasted. Again, it never occurred to me that I had this allergy. I thought I was just a bad person. I just thought that I was weak. I thought all these things, I never thought. And it was a habit that I couldn't break. And it talks about here the reliance upon things human, that the problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Well, that was me. It's a heck of a place to be in that merry-go-round, but that's where I was, and I'm going to stick to this because, until I really got it through my thick head that everything that we've been reading was me and I quit making excuses, it was only then that I was able to achieve any kind of sobriety. And I've been sober longer this time than I have in my entire life. And I think it's really because I finally, you mentioned the doctor's opinion and stuff. I mean, when I would read that stuff, I'd go, that's me, But if there's any little bit of doubt in my thinking, and I'm looking back on why I was bouncing around so much and why I could never maintain any kind of real sobriety, it was because I think deep, deep down, I wasn't as bad as you. It's interesting, me and Rich were talking about it earlier, that in AA, you'll see people, that before they reach that point of the misery being so bad that they're willing to do something about it, they step off the elevator at different floors. And, you see some people that they got fired from a few jobs, they think they better get sober, or, they lose their family, or some people end up on the meat table like they're about to die, and they finally wake up and say, gee, I better take this seriously. And some people end up on the street. And I knew a guy here, an older gentleman in AA, I haven't seen him in a long time, but he ended up on the street, and he would tell me that while he was on the street, he would compare himself to other bums on the street and tell himself that he wasn't as bad as them. And I could understand that, you know. And then I took him home from a meeting one day, and I saw on the wall he had a degree in accounting from Harvard University. And I said, wow, you've got a degree from Harvard? He goes, yeah. And I just was astonished. And I thought, you know, this thing is, it doesn't matter how smart you are, how stupid you are, how young you are, how old you are. You know, we all got the same condition. And when somebody starts telling these wacky stories, we all start laughing at the tragic stuff. It's because we understand. We understand what it's like. And I, you know, I'm just grateful today that I finally stepped off the elevator. And I'll tell you the truth, the only reason I keep coming back is I don't trust myself. I do not trust myself. Does time mean something? Yeah, it means something. There, you know, it means something, but it also doesn't mean anything. I realize that I'm that close to twisting off. And not only because of the stories that you tell, but I got my own stories to tell. I can look at my own experience and know that I don't trust myself. And, you know, this is a condition that requires treatment. And, you know, fortunately, it's free. Fortunately, no one's trying to sell me anything in here. And it doesn't really require that much effort when you come to think about it, because some people that have some serious conditions, you know, they would jump through hoops if all they had to do was do what I have to do to stay, you know, live a reasonably normal life. Thanks.
Thanks. There's a little bit of talking about unmanageability here, where Jack was talking about their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that looks very different for different people. Like I said the last time, this disease is very progressive. It starts off bad and it gets worse, was my experience. My drinking in college didn't look anything like my drinking at the end. In college, you know, I drank as often as I could, you know, but I never drank alone. I would go to a party basically six nights a week because I needed to drink and I didn't know why. I just thought I was having a good time. And the consequences were my grades were slipping, you know. Fast forward to the end of my drinking looked like me hiding airplane bottles in my purse to drink in the bathroom at work. To get through the shift, and my marriage was about to come to an end. So not only does the drinking progress, but a lot of times the bad stuff, like literally, like it says, the problems pile up and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I was astonished. But yeah, the fact that this phenomenon of craving never occurs in the average Shimpert drinker. If you need an example of that, just think of any time you've been at a drinking occasion with friends who don't drink like you, who don't drink alcoholically. I'm thinking of one time in particular, I shared this recently. This was just a memory that came back to me recently. I was living in Norfolk at the time, and my friend was in Newport News and having a bonfire. And it was a group of us from college, and as far as I know, the rest of my friends in this particular group drank pretty normally. And, you know, everybody was nursing beers, I think, like, and I was watching pretty closely. They were drinking like one beer an hour, and I was like, what the heck? And I'm trying to figure out how many times I can go into the kitchen for beer without looking weird. So the best I could do was one every 15 minutes. And I'm like, are they noticing? And not only that, I had spotted a handle of something that didn't belong to me on top of the fridge, and I was nipping out of that too. And I thought this was, you know, I'm like, what's wrong with everybody else? Let's get the party started. This is a bonfire. Eventually, I had to leave because they were not drinking like I needed to drink. So I drove home to Norfolk, and I couldn't even make it home. I had to stop off at the Thirsty Camel on my way home to drink some more because my buzz, whatever, was wearing off. And that right there, you know, everybody comes in a different level. You don't have to be, there's no amount of drinks you have to be at in order to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, in order to be an alcoholic, in order to be done. but I know that I did not drink like other people. And in most cases, because kind of like Jack was saying, I often found people who drank like me to hang out with. But if I tried to hang out with my like normie friends, it was miserable. I was coming out of my skin. I was super self-conscious about, you know, hiding. I mean, the hiding was terrible. So if you're finding that you're hiding, you're drinking, that's probably a sign that you might be in the right place. That was a big tip off for me. I talked about the progressiveness of the illness. And it's only ever going to get worse. We never grow new legs. Some people talk about the pickle analogy. Once you pickle a cucumber, it's never going to be a cucumber again. You can't unpickle it. And it's kind of cute and funny, but I need stuff like that. I have a simple mind to remind myself that I can never go back to drinking normally. If I ever did, I don't really remember a time when I did. From my first drink, I knew that I needed more and more and more. That physical allergy was pretty much always there. So I think that's all I have to share for that one. Thanks.
All right. Continuing on page XXVIII. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
I don't know about you, but that describes me to a T. And that's the story of my life right there in that paragraph. And that restless, irritable discontent, my whole life centered around drinking. I loved the way drinking and drugs made me feel. That's just all there is to it. I drank because I didn't like the way I felt, and I liked the effects produced by alcohol and drugs. Alcohol happened to be my drug of choice. And, you know, I could think about, one of my things was, being a functioning alcoholic, a workaholic. You know, I could hide from myself by submersing myself in 12 to 14 hours a day of work, 6 days a week, and drinking any chance I could in between and during. And I did that for a long, long time. I would eat ibuprofens in the morning. I mean, I would not let myself drink in the morning, you know, because I didn't want to go to work like that. But, you know, thinking nobody knew. Of course, everybody knew. I got fired from many jobs. But, you know, I would take ibuprofens and stuff to try to get rid of the hangovers and go show up at work. And then, you know, just gutting it through the day, every day. That was the story of my life. And, all of a sudden around 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's like, oh, I think I'm starting to feel a little better. And I was like, ding, 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 ding. How soon can I get a drink, you know? And I just couldn't wait to get a drink. And boy, those first 3 or 4 was just, you know. Sometimes I would drink them so fast. And I would drink beer, you know. Towards the end, I was getting away from liquor and drinking beer and wine because I was drinking so fast that, you know, I could, you know, remember just taking beers and just chugging them so fast to try to get the first two down that I would vomit because I just took too much too fast. And I would just, you know, many times I was driving and I'd open up the barf and just, you know, drink some more. That was normal to me, you know? If I told that to another group of people that were normal, they'd look at me like I was some sicko. We all go, yeah. We talk about hiding. I mean, I had so many hiding places, but the best story I ever heard about hiding, this guy got me beat. It was at an AA meeting in Alexandria. This guy said that his wife couldn't figure out, you know, he found all his stashes, right? And he shows up drunk and she couldn't figure out where he was hiding it. And he said that he took the He emptied out the windshield washer reservoir in his car, and he filled it with scotch, and he ran the tube through the firewall, and when he would pump the thing, he would sit there with a straw. And I said, well, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. I said, buddy, I can't top that one. But we will go to any length, you know. But you know that the first few drinks of just getting that feeling of was just that was wonderful. I could feel it now just talking about it. And I was like, man, if I could just stop there. If I could just stop there, there wouldn't be any problem. Doggone it, I wouldn't be here. All the stuff that happened to me, the DUIs, jails, lost relationships, fired jobs, missed opportunities. I mean, none of that would have happened if I could have just stopped at 3 or 4. Everything would have been okay. That's what normal people can do. The kind that have a couple of drinks and say, no, I had enough, I'm starting to feel it now. I'd look at them like, are you crazy? I mean, that's when we just get started. But that's the thing. And the problem is I couldn't stop. And we all know the story. It was pedal to the metal. And I'd stop when I ran out or passed out. And what happened in between usually wasn't very good. And if the story was different, I wouldn't be here. But that's the curse of alcoholism, I think. It's just the fact that I can't stop. And I finally got to a point where I said, okay, I've had enough misery in my life. And if you believe what it says in the doctor's opinion, it says that we have a fatal condition. And that's pretty serious, isn't it? Fatal. I mean, do you believe you have a fatal condition? If not, what are you doing here? I mean, it says right there very clearly, we have a fatal, incurable condition. Medical science hasn't figured out a way to solve it. They've made a lot of advances with breast cancer and all different kinds of cancer, but not alcoholism. I mean, it's pretty stark in there. And this is the thing, I always had this little bit of doubt, like I said. I'm just not quite that. I don't think it's really fatal for me. You know, but it says we're either going to end up dead or incarcerated in some manner. And, the experiences in my life was the elevator was going down. And after 18 years of playing with this, coming in and out, geographical cures, meetings all over the country, I finally realized, yes, it's gotten a lot worse. Yes, I can't take it anymore. I don't want to lose anymore. What do I have to do to sober up?
Thanks. I like how the readings we did before this one were about what happens when we have the alcohol in us, and this one was about what happens when we don't have any in us. It's almost worse in some cases. They're restless, irritable, and discontented until they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Ooh, man, I remember even as a kid, that restless, irritable, discontent, long before I ever had my first drink, I was never comfortable in my own skin, man, and basically all that means is I was terrified of people. I remember as a little girl going to see my cousins who were my age, I would hide behind my mom and dad's legs for the first 24 hours we stayed with them, because I was just that kind of shy person. And in middle school, I never spoke to anybody. I kind of isolated. I was just afraid of what you were thinking about me. And, just terrified of everything. And the first time I took a drink, I just felt this humongous relaxation. It was like, for the very first time, I was comfortable around my peers. I was at this party, and it wasn't like some big crazy party. It was just like it was maybe like 10 people in the countryside at a friend's house. And before then, I could barely ever look a guy in the eye, and it just so happened that night, my first drunk, I had my first kiss, and he held my hand. It was the first time I'd ever held hands with anybody, and I made that connection. I said, drink equals sociable and normal. That's all I ever wanted, was just to be normal. so this is why I need the drink. I make that association. That paired with the physical allergy, paired with the mental obsession, man, I'm not going to get away from it without something, without a spiritual solution. The last thing Ryan read was, this is repeated over and over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And my sponsor had me write next to psychic change in my big book, meaning outside the possibilities defining natural laws. And I did have that psychic change, and that was my experience. It was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. I literally tried everything to stop drinking. Everything. Went to a therapist, got married, changed jobs. Moved, you know, I even left my job bartending to get a daytime job in my field. None of that stuff worked. It wasn't even like it worked temporarily. It just kept getting worse and worse. Through coming to AA, finally being licked, asking somebody for help and working these steps, that is the only thing that's ever changed me. I am not the same person. This is not the same mind. So much that I don't drink anymore. And that was nothing I did. All I did was followed a few simple steps and took some instructions and became willing to go to any lengths. And after X amount of time in AA, the obsession to drink was removed from me. And this is something that I get to work for the rest of my life. And I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to do it. And I hope I always feel that way. But even more than being free from the obsession to drink, I have lots of moments where I am comfortable in my own skin. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that every waking moment of every day, I feel like a million bucks. I still get scared. I still am intimidated by life. I still get annoyed when I have to be an adult. But I've learned to walk through these things, and it gets easier and easier, and I could not do that without AA. I could not do that without getting a higher power who helps me whenever I ask. Honest to goodness, he just wants me to ask. This is a solution, and if you're here and you're new, you can have that experience too. Thanks for letting me share.
All right, now we'll move over to page XXIV. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal, which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Yeah, my friend Brad made the supreme sacrifice. I already mentioned him, but the thing about the craving setting in, that used to happen to me when I'd leave AA meetings. This last time, it really scared me because, you know, for 18 years going in and out, I always knew that AA worked. And then this time, I was really trying. I was going to meetings every day. I would hang out at the Easy Does It Club because I just couldn't get through the day, you know, between meetings. And I'd leave a meeting feeling great, you know, and then feeling great. I mean, you know, not wanting to drink. I'd get in the car and I couldn't make it past the 7-Eleven. I picked up several white chips. Started coming back in July, I think, of 09, and it took a few white chips after that because the obsession was so strong. I probably should have been in treatment, really. Now that I look back on it, it would have been easier if I went to detox or something. But nevertheless, that obsession was so powerful. And if you're an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about. And I blew a lot of good things, too, like it says in that paragraph. The good news is, like BJ touched on it, you know, this isn't all gloom and doom. It's gloom and doom if I'm drinking, but the good news is that I hung in there, and I can't say when, but I got a sponsor pretty quick, and got some marching orders on what to do to stay sober. Did probably half of what was suggested, and somewhere, I don't know, about 2 or 3 months into it, the obsession was gone. And I'm telling you, to have that monkey off my back is a miracle. I'm a walking, talking miracle. I believe that 100%. The way I used to drink and do drugs, it's amazing I'm still sitting here. And I appreciate that, and I'm grateful for that every day. And like BJ said, oh, you know, life's not a bowl of cherries, and they didn't have any parades because Jack got sober. you know, it's fact, I look back and I think it's like, it was like I was in the tornado shelter when I sobered up, and I jumped into the shelter and the tornado went by, and after I sobered up, after a few months, I came out and I looked around and everything was destroyed and there was just a few sticks, and I had to like rebuild everything. It's tough. You know, sobering up was so hard for me that kept me from going back out a lot in the first couple of years. Just thinking about how hard it was sobering up this last time. You know, I hear people in meetings say, well, I don't know if I have another sobering up to do. I'd say, yeah, right. If I drink, I'm going to die. I'd say, okay, good for you, buddy. You know, but, you know, this time, I come back to meetings with people, I was bouncing off the walls this last time. I'd sit in meetings and I'd say, I hate this. I don't want to be here. I don't like AA. You know, I don't like this. And people come up and say, it's okay, Jack. Keep coming back, buddy. You know, you'll be all right. And then people come up and say, yeah, thanks for sharing. You really helped me. And I think, yeah, you know, I'm glad I can help you. Because, you know that you're not as messed up as me. That's what you really mean. And you feel happy now that you heard me open up my mouth and keep my guts out here. You know, that you're in a lot better shape than me. I'm glad I could be of help. I wouldn't say that then, but that's what I would think. And, but the good news is that, you know, life is hard, man. And the good news is that, you know, I couldn't get through life without drinking. And the good news of AA is that, you know, I can now. And, sometimes they get into pity parties. Sometimes they go into depression. Sometimes they get anxious. Sometimes, you know, all the things that normal people experience, you know. But the miracle is I don't have to get loaded to deal with it anymore. And I got friends now, and I've got, things have gotten so much better. I mean, my life is like nothing I could have ever imagined it to be when I was drinking. And I'm really grateful for that.
Thanks for sharing. Kind of playing off what Jack just said. Life does still show up. You still get down in the dumps and feel sorry for yourself. But not only do you not have to drink over it anymore, you don't have to stay in that place, because this is such a beautiful design for living. We don't have to walk around depression anymore. And that was that freedom that I was talking about the last time. That's even better than the gift of sobriety, is the emotional sobriety is incredible. Getting back to this paragraph, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. Yeah, after I've been sober for a while in AA, my dad made a comment to me, see, I knew you had it in you. I knew you could get sober. And in my head, I'm thinking, yeah, I tried to quit drinking on my own for the last 5 years I was drinking, and it didn't work. And just a coincidence that I come to AA and finally I can stop drinking. But yeah, it's me. I did it. You know what I mean? But that's okay. I don't go there. You know what I mean? They're just happy I'm sober. But he doesn't understand because he's not an alcoholic. He hasn't had this experience. Doesn't matter. But I just think it's kind of funny how to the outside person, you know, oh yeah, see, I told you could stop, but not on my own, man. Not without getting help. So I had this friend in college who was probably one of us. I don't know where he is now, but we would party at pretty much every night. And this guy always got ballroom blitzed, man. And he'd wake up with like blood trickling out his ear, and like it was bad. And I remember a lot of our friends would be like, dude, you got to calm it down with the drinking. And I never said that to him because I think I knew he did not have that ability. Like, and I also knew I wouldn't want to just have one or two. Like, why would you? So in my mind, it was weird. I was like, oh, I'm not that bad yet. But I also understood why he was doing what he was doing. And just where it really does not come down to mental control for us. If you are a true alcoholic, you might even go a couple years out drinking, but you're going to go back to it. You don't have a choice, that mental obsession. The part about Dr. Silkworth is talking about seeing alcoholics who will be sober and then a big date will come up where they have to hold an appointment and they'll just totally get drunk 2 days before and blow everything. I have an experience to share about that. It's not the exact same, but it's similar. So when I read that part, I always think of a friend of mine had a major surgery. She was one of my best friends. She lives in Richmond. She had major surgery, and she was receiving visitors. And I had planned on going to Richmond to visit her in the hospital. She doesn't have a lot of family left. And I drove up there, and on my way, another friend of mine who lived in Richmond said, "Hey, come over. You should swing by." And we started drinking. And I never made it to see my friend in the hospital who'd had surgery. And it really hurt her feelings. Like, that was the whole reason I was going up there, was to visit this friend who just had surgery. And I started drinking and it never happened. And that's just one of many stories like that I can tell. And I mean, you know, that's not exactly like the story Dr. Silkworth is telling, but that's how I relate to that. And kind of along those lines too, life does not have to be bad for me to want to drink. Some of my worst drunks started off when I was in a celebratory mode, whether life was just going really well and I had my guard down. Seriously, I have to be so on guard when life is good, almost more than when it's bad. Because if I'm an alcoholic, I'm going to drink no matter what, and that disease is going to creep in when I least expect it. And it's usually around the time when, you know, I get a work promotion or something positive is happening in my life. It does not discriminate it. The bit about making the supreme sacrifice, Jack already touched on this. Basically, if I do not get a spiritual solution, one of a few things is going to happen. I'm going to drink myself to death, I'm going to drink somebody else to death and be incarcerated, or I'm going to blow my brains out. I mean, my jumping off place, I think if I hadn't come to AA, I was suicidal, you know. My last drunk was definitely not my worst. I just got to a point where I woke up and I said, I can't do this anymore. I cannot go another day drinking. I don't know how to not drink. I want to die. And that evening I came to AA and found a sponsor. And that's the only reason I'm still here. I believe it to the depths of my being, because I did not have a will to live. Like, what's the point? I was miserable. And so I think that's kind of what that part of the doctor's opinion is alluding to when it says causes someone to make the supreme sacrifice. There are worse things than drinking, unfortunately. If you're new and you are done, you don't have to keep doing this, man. Like, it does not have to stay this dark. It really doesn't. When I got here, I felt like I was in hell's waiting room. It wasn't even funny. And today I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. We got one more paragraph on page XXX. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
Well, that about sums it up. There's no cure, but we can get relief by complete abstinence. And, for someone that alcohol was the solution, that's that was a hard pill to swallow because I kept trying. Well, maybe it'll be different this time. Yeah, maybe I'll be able to handle it this time. And, you know, sometimes we get away with it. And that gives us some little, gives me a little glimmer of hope that it might still yet be different. But then, of course, it just continues to get worse. And, you know, that incomprehensible demoralization, you know, the total pathetic remorse. God, that's awful. And swearing I'm never going to do it again and really meaning it, you know, and not being able to stop. It is. It's really pretty simple. I mean, I have a condition that, you know, that once I put alcohol in my body, it's like there's this tiger in a cage inside of me. And, you know, sobering up, the tiger got in the cage and it was running around for a while. The obsession left, and now that tiger's in hibernation. And I can get on with life, and I can learn how to live. I could look normal. We could all look normal out there, you know. And that tiger is in hibernation. And the times that I drank again, many times it just started, it started with a drink. I mean, how else could it start? And it's like, you know, that tiger just all of a sudden, the eyes opened up when that first drink went down. And then there were times when I sobered up, like maybe I got drunk a couple of times and ran back to AA. And God, it was hard because the tiger was pacing inside the cage. And I couldn't stay sober longer than 3 months or 4 months. The tiger just wouldn't go back to sleep, you know. I drank again. And that merry-go-round was going on like that for me for, like I said, almost 20 years. And, you know, that analogy is how I look at it. I mean, I'm okay as long as I don't pick up a drink. And as long as I keep that my number one priority in life, no matter what else is going on, you know, that tiger is going to stay in hibernation and I'm going to be okay. Because I've already found out in my own life, as soon as I take one drink, the eyes pop open. And it's either going to be pacing the cage as I try to struggle again to sober up one more time, or it's going to be let out, and it's going to be a raging tiger. You know, that's just how it is. The freedom, you know, I thought I was in control when I was totally out of control. And by surrendering to this simple fact of this condition that I have, just to surrender to it and say, okay, I give up. I'm going to quit fighting. What do I have to do? And just take the few simple suggestions that the program offers. I'm able to learn how to live like a normal person, reasonably happy. Instead of my life being like a roller coaster, going like this all the time, it's more like this, like a boat sailing on the water, you know? And I try not to let things get me too upset, because I know that if I'm going to get angry, upset, too happy, too sad, whatever, I'm going to look for relief. And that's what the program's for. It gives me relief. If I don't keep my feet in the program, I'm going to get relief somewhere. And if it's not in AA as an alcoholic, it's going to be the bottle again. So I choose to keep this my number one priority in life. And the good news is, aside from being sober, is that no matter what kind of a day I have a luxury that most other people don't have. See, because being an alcoholic and being sober, instead of passing out every night when I go to sleep, if I had a total bad day, I mean, it couldn't be any worse. I could put my head on a pillow and say, you know what, I'm still a winner because I didn't drink today. I could say my prayers and thank God for helping me stay sober, for keeping me sober one more day. I'm a success. I'm on my way because I'm either sliding backwards or I'm going forwards. My life is never static. So my life is skidding back into the pits, was in the pit, and now is moving forward and being accelerated. And I like that.
What this tells me and what I know is that I can never have alcohol safely in any form. And what that means is I don't mess around with she crab soup. Like, I mean, there are a bajillion things that I can ingest. I don't want to taste anything that reminds me of something I'm addicted to. Like, why would I do that? Odules, absolutely not. You know what I mean? Like, that even has alcohol. Kombucha, nope. Anything that has alcohol in it or tastes like alcohol, reminds me of alcohol, I leave alone. Mouthwash, nope. And this is why I need a sponsor, because I don't come into AA knowing all these things. What if I have surgery and I need to be on painkillers? Well, we'll show you how to do that too. Because some people, you know, you have a tooth pulled, that you might need to go on some kind of narcotic. And the truth is that anything that's going to alter the way I feel or alter my mind, I need to look out for, because that can send me back down the road to drinking so fast. So that's really about being open and honest. I mean, I haven't been there yet. I would definitely be like super transparent with my sponsor if that were the case. But I can never safely use alcohol in any form. And I just need to really be careful with that. And that's what I got out of that one. And I think that's all I have to share. Thanks.
All right. Thank you guys very much. That was our last reading. Thank our panel, and I will start passing this one. All right. The seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help alcoholics who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Do we have any AA-related announcements? Nothing. All righty. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. All right, newcomers. Is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety so that we can welcome you?
Hi, Calvin.
Hey, Calvin, welcome.
Foy, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Foy, welcome. Hey, Melissa, welcome.
That's it. All righty. We have a literature available on the table to your left. Please see me or any other home group after the meeting if you would like some. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come up and talk with me. And just a reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. So, one last time, thank you to the panel for sharing. And after we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol, just down Colonial, before 22nd Street. Can I get someone to read the last paragraphs on page 164? Yes, sir.
Alcoholic, hey, David.
David.
You guys know the difference between an O'Doul's and a real Budweiser?
No.
What? About 30 days. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the records of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you in the land.
All right, let's close with the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah.